hello, hello. Welcome back to the Almas Podcast. My name is Gabriella Love, and I am your host. Thank you so very much for being here with us today, for listening to this episode. I am excited to have the conversation that we are about to have with an incredible, incredible person. And this is just based on the kinds of things I've seen on their website, the kinds of things that they're up to, and hearing a bit about their name. I thought that was really, really cool. It gave me a great insight into, I feel like names represent something, and their name being Minachi, I think that's representing a lot. So we'll see what happens. Minachi, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to the Almas Podcast. Feel free to take a moment or two to introduce yourself.
Is it okay if I say something before I introduce myself?
Absolutely.
Are you aware of how truly, tremendously good you are at this?
What?
For folks who are listening, you know, like normally podcasts, at least what I assume of podcasts is that, you know, you do the interview and then the host goes back and the times when I've had to edit things, you know, that intro piece, like I'll take time to really do it and craft it. And what you all just heard just came out of Gabriella's mouth literally right now, which I think is like, you're really good at this.
Oh, wow. I was not expecting to hear that at all. Wow. Yeah. Thank you. I'm receiving what you just said in a way that's it's really emphasizing maybe potentially like the blessing that's there, the gift that's there, the beauty that's there. And I appreciate it because I definitely, you know, not so much downplay things anymore, but I don't necessarily really lean into, oh, wow, like this is really good. So thank you. That's it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to have brought into the space. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. It was really lovely to witness. And I think I will introduce myself so that that's there. It just reminds me so much of like, it reminds me so much of why I started doing what I do. So my name is Minachi. I use they, them pronouns. I'm a Cancer sun with a Capricorn rising. And I teach nonviolent communication, but with a trauma-informed and a decolonial lens. And I think the piece that was coming up for me just now really was, you know, I had studied NVC, nonviolent communication, for well over 15 years, much closer to 20 before I started making offerings. And the reason that I wasn't teaching for so long was because I just didn't think that I was good enough, or I didn't think I had something to offer. And I had some experiences that reminded me that our community thrives and benefits when we acknowledge and honor what we have to offer to our communities and when we make those offerings. And so I'm feeling that now, like in terms of just your gift at like how good you are at like, you know, kind of like what I've shared before at like stewarding these conversations, or even just how seamlessly that intro came together, is a reminder that we all have gifts that maybe we underestimate or that seem quote, quote, normal to us, but they are magic for our community.
Mm, yeah, beautiful. I just have to say, so for everyone that's listening, before we started the podcast, I was outside having a moment to myself, and I was reminded of this experience that I have, which is just a fairly commonplace experience for me. When I'm about to engage with someone, I generally start to feel something energetically about the space that I'm going to enter with that person, or the interaction, the kind of quality of energy that that's going to have. And so I was outside and suddenly I was feeling very calm, and suddenly I just felt this calmness wash over me. And then I got here and I told Minachi about that. And it's funny because as I'm listening to you, I'm feeling that calmness. I'm feeling it just coming out of, and it's beautiful. It's just really cool to share that and have that witnessed. There are so many things I want to talk to you about, but I want to just ask you if there's something for you in this moment that comes up as the first thing that you'd like to talk about.
I don't think so. I think I have a similar sense of like, there's many things I think I feel excited to talk to you about, and I don't have a sense of what feels good to share or go into first.
Sounds good. Okay, cool. All right. Well, that being the case, nonviolent communication. How or when did the other piece come into play? That piece being decolonial or decolonization. How did that come about?
That came directly from my mentor. So I'm really, really fortunate that the person who introduced me to nonviolent communication, we share the same home country and we speak the same mother tongue. And her name is Jayanthi Siva, and I love her so deeply. She's currently based out of the Netherlands, but she was born in Sri Lanka. And in 83, the riots happened. I was born in 83. I was born in Black July. That same year, her family fled. My family was already out. And, you know, just through the course of diaspora journeys, we both ended up in the Bay Area. And in 2002, there was a ceasefire back home. And my Amma had heard about this woman who's doing a fundraiser to move back to Sri Lanka and teach NVC. And both my Amma and I, and my Amma is my mother, were like, we don't know what that thing is, but we got to find out who that woman is. And so, you know, Jayanthika just has become this great light in my life. Just really fortunate and blessed to have participated in the work she has carried for so many years. And at some point, you know, the conversation came up of the ways in which nonviolent communication was reinforcing patterns of white supremacy in the training she was facilitating back home. And when there would be guest trainers coming into the country who didn't understand the cultural landscape, and we both were seeing a lot of things. So in terms of where it came from, for me, it really initiated through conversations with her.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Beautiful. First of all, I just want to take a moment to say thank you for sharing your love and appreciation for this person. I think that that's, I feel grateful to get to hear you share that. That said, so, you know, you began to notice the way in which nonviolent communication was manifesting white supremacist sort of conditioning maybe, or ideas. What does that look like now? Now that you've kind of worked in this way for a while, like, give me what's, I guess I'm trying to understand this a bit better. What this actually looks like. Can you give us an example?
That is a good question. It's a really valuable question. When I talk about decolonizing nonviolent communication, I'm really talking about, actually I might read something, but what I'm talking about is the practice itself of nonviolent communication, which was developed by Marshall Rosenberg. And that modality, as he developed it, doesn't have a strong praxis of talking about systems of power and how systems of power impact our communication or impact our behavior and ways of being. And I just pulled up my book, and one of the quotes that I really love, which comes from a person named Himakshi Piplani, and I'm so grateful also to her for saying these words and then allowing me to use them, is Himakshi said, "I understand decolonizing NVC to mean actively removing colonial mindset and colonizing values from NVC praxis so that nonviolence no longer serves as a tool of the settler colonial agenda." And I think that, you know, overall, images that we receive of what nonviolence looks like tend to be very, quote, quote, peaceful, right? Quiet, sort of like forms of direct action that don't include, for example, direct reclamations of property or direct reclamation of resources, right? Just moving through the streets quietly or in an organized fashion. Those are, I think, when I think about the imagery of what gets labeled as nonviolent, it's like those things. Whereas people going into stores or houses and actively engaging in resource redistribution are tagged with like behaving in violent ways, or that's where the label of rioting comes in. And so it's really just this question of what do we even mean when we say nonviolence if we're living in an occupied state, in unoccupied territory? If I am paying rent for housing on occupied land, what are the ways that I'm complicit or participating in systems of violence that maybe don't get acknowledged or don't get talked about?
Yeah, this is very juicy. Yeah. So are there experiences that you can share that you can think of where you experienced this yourself?
So something I guess that I can share. So I was a facilitator at an event a couple weeks ago, and the people in the space were predominantly white. And a lot of the people in the space just had a hard time with like when I just presented what my subject matter was going to be. A lot of people became very activated, and structures of support were set up for people to receive care for how much they had been activated. And, you know, it's like there's nothing new about it. You know what I mean? Like, there's really nothing new. And there's so many other stories. This is like a micro moment, it almost feels like. But again, it's just like coming back and, you know, and I know that, like, so my teacher was the one who was organizing the summit, and she was the one setting up these structures of care and support for these people who were activated by the subject matter of my presentation. And right, she was moving from a place of wanting to hold deep care for everybody in the space. And she also is increasingly politicized, but her politicization reaches a particular point, as does mine. And so there were ways in which the power of whiteness just got reinforced in the space, and care was not actually universally distributed, right? Like, I didn't receive any care in those moments when those white people were being really racist to me. And so it's all those moments of noticing the context in which our behavior really sits.
Yeah. It gets me thinking about, I find at least for me, this process of decolonizing my own ideas and perceptions and the way in which I navigate the world or how I relate to things is a very rewarding and enlightening journey. Mm-hmm. And it's also a very confusing process sometimes. And I think that's because there's, like, on one level, I look at things and I go, oh, this is a very clear extension, if you will, of colonization. This is a very clear extension of white supremacy. And then there are things where I find myself in scenarios wondering if the thing that I was doing to combat or to change the white supremacy in that particular scenario, or the colonization, like the legacy of it, the thing that I end up doing is actually still an extension of that very legacy. And that gets very confusing to me. I don't know if that makes sense. Did that kind of explain what I'm trying to get at
what
there?
What I will say is that resonates very deeply for me. And I think it resonates very deeply for me. And I think some of the things that come up, you know, are like, I sometimes, you know, my work is centered on, it's, you know, I have a workbook that's called Decolonizing Nonviolent Communication, and it's out there, right? So it's kind of like its own thing. I'm not sure that I would even use that word anymore, because I think sometimes I don't even know what that word means. And like, what does it even mean for me? Like, right? Like, because the example that I used is very true of, I pay rent on colonized land, and so there's ways in which I participate in the system. And so what are any of the boundaries or the lines? And I think that a deep part of my praxis is always recognizing the self in the other. And so even kind of like, as I was saying, right, like, you know, my teacher in this instance has her limits, but I can also see myself in her, and I can see myself in those really racist people. I don't think that there's a part of me that has never participated. It's not like I've been flawless in my behavior, because I am reflected in everything, everywhere. So it's like we're moving through reflections of shadow and light, and what brings out the versions of us that we want to keep.
Yeah. It's funny that you framed it that way. A couple of days ago, well, actually, I think that was Friday. On Friday, I had a bit of an introspective day. I decided to just kind of take the time because I'd been feeling triggered the week before. So I sat with myself and communed with some medicine and did a bit of work. And I really, you know, for many of those moments, I was facing the truth and the reality of my own participation, and not just participating in, you know, legacies of colonization and white supremacy in a way that is harmful to myself, but also participating in a way that's harmful to others. And really just looking at that and recognizing all of the ways, or at least many of the ways in which I've participated. And so that, for me, kind of brought me to a place of just sitting with accountability and how I hold myself accountable, and then how I hold others accountable and what that means to me. So I'm curious to hear how accountability fits into all of this for you.
Oh, this is so... Accountability is something that I think about often. And I think particularly just in so many facets of how I came to my work. Because people think that, like, you know, because I've written this workbook called Decolonizing Nonviolent Communication, that I'm like some communication expert and that I have, you know, these skills or something. And I do have some skills, particularly I think when I'm facilitating, right? Because there's different versions of us that come out when we play different roles. So when I'm facilitating, I'm on. And I think I, you know, just like I think you are so skilled just in what I've seen here, you know, when I'm facilitating, I'm pretty good at my work. But my work has come from so many active fuck-ups in real life of causing pretty consistent harm and acting in ways that are actually not aligned with my values. And it's been really something to think about, because some of the things that I've been finding are, first of all, accountability requires relationship. And it doesn't mean that we have to be in direct relationship with the person that we harmed. I think oftentimes that is unsafe, right? But we require bridges of relationship to each other, because it is only through relationship that we know, how can I tell that the changes I'm making actually keep you safer? How can I know that the behaviors I'm shifting are the qualities and version of accountability that actually meet your needs for accountability and that meet my needs for transformation? We can't do accountability work without access to each other in some way, shape, or form. And I feel like, I think what comes up is like, we don't all have to be in relationship with each other all at the same time. That's not the goal. But I think that the goal in part is figuring out who is it that has the capacity, the desire, the sense of purpose at being part of the bridge building work, because the bridges need to exist. Otherwise, we're all just screaming into the wind. And some people are experiencing harm and other people are causing harm and not knowing how to change.
Yeah. So I don't want to interrupt you, but
please,
I just
do.
Want to ask.
Please do.
So bridge building, I think that's a lot easier, well, first of all, said than done, but also a lot easier when you're building a bridge to either something or someone that doesn't feel, that we're not experiencing as a cause or a source of harm. It's a lot more challenging when the thing or the person that we're built or want to build a bridge towards, we're experiencing that as causing us harm or causing harm in general. And that I find is where the challenge lies. So what, I guess in your experience of building bridges, how has that process changed for you? What have you learned, you know, that has made that easier?
I'm like, yo, first of all, I don't know. Second of all. I think that for me, to some extent, this is where surrender and trust come in, trusting that there is an abundance of resources and that I don't have to do more than what is actually within my capacity, that the bridges will be built and that more harm will happen when I try to force a bridge or when it's a shaky bridge. You know what I mean? Like, that has been a big lesson for me lately.
Yeah, I feel that 100,000%. There is something liberating and also logical, or ironically logical, about acceptance of where we are, what we're able to do in that moment, what we are doing in that moment, just accepting and surrendering to a reality in which whatever that is okay, and it doesn't need to be anything other than what it is. That's a really beautiful place to be. And so, yeah, thank you for that reminder. It's beautiful. And also, I also don't know. So I definitely feel you on that. Nothing we're saying is anything at all. It's everything and nothing. Oh, man. All right. What's your favorite thing about communication?
Oh, my God. Oh, again, a very tender moment. I think I love the moments of surprise. Love the moments of unexpected connection. You know, it's that juiciness. It's that plug-in point of, like, it's the moments that come after rupture has occurred and we think this can never be fixed. And when we hit that moment of acknowledgement and accountability, when someone says the right thing and you get to say, yes, that is the thing I've been waiting for you to say. There's just so many good moments in there. It's reminding me a little bit. So I used to volunteer at the Suicide Prevention Center. And I had a call once that has stuck with me my whole life, or, you know, since that moment, where this caller had pretty severe depression and was calling because they didn't want to die that night. And we talked about the reality of the fact that their waves of depression would just come back, you know, after we got off the call. And they really liked playing the guitar. And there are a couple of the things that we liked about it. And we had a really good connection on the call. And I said, maybe it's this. Like, maybe this is what we live for, these moments in between when the waves are not hitting us so hard. And that was kind of where we landed for that night and that call. And I think about that because, you know, one of the hard things about relationships and communication is there's always going to be rupture. Like, we're always going to get into another. If we go deep enough, if we're truly in relationship, someone is always going to cause harm again. Like, harm is never off the table. And so how do we savor those moments of sweetness and connection in a way that stabilizes us through the next moment of impact?
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. There's a direction I want to go in next. But before I do that, something just came up for me in sort of sitting with what you've shared. There are moments in which, you know, I'm aware of, you know, the way in which I'm communicating, whether that's through body language or through intention or with a, you know, thought pattern that I'm holding space for in my mind, or you know, actually acting those things out in either subtle ways or non so subtle ways. And I'm aware of them, and this generally happens when I'm
you know, feeling triggered by something, and then I'm either not taking enough time and space for myself to process that, and so I'm kind of just carrying all this weight around for a bit, and because of that, I don't have the energetic space to focus on all the other things, and that's where I kind of find myself falling into those patterns. But when it happens, I'm aware of it. And the interesting piece there is that because I'm aware of it, I am forced to be honest with myself about it, because I'm literally walking around with a mirror, and everywhere I look, my own actions or lack of action is reflected back at me. And so, like, that's just an experience that I was reminded of as I was listening to you. Is that something you can relate to?
That's such a beautiful image of, like, just the mirror and the reflections of how our behaviors reflect the resolved or unresolved things that are still happening inside of us.
Yeah. Yeah. And you would think that noticing it and being aware of it would be enough to change it. kind of just experiencing them anyway. it's funny to think about it. It's good. Life is a good journey.
Okay, can I respond to that a little bit? Okay, life is definitely a good journey. And I don't know who the fuck just, like, has us convinced that because we're supposed to recognize something and then resolve it on our own. That is not how we work, right? There are reasons we are reflections of each other. There are reasons that our behavior manifests outside, and it's so that somebody else can catch it and say, hey, I see you in pain. I see you hurting. Would you like to sit down by this tree? And the three of us will commune together, and we'll call in the wind, and we'll listen to the squirrels, and we'll just explore and sit with and be with the thing that is going on for you. Right? So it's like our behaviors are always call-ins and requests for support and care from those in our environment. And I think that the other piece you named about, like, you know, not having the time and spaciousness to sit, I think that, you know, I am aware that a lot of what I do requires that spaciousness and time. Right. And it's one of the reasons that I always say my work should not be the only thing in your toolkit, because we need people who know how to create other types of change in the world in order to enable people to have the time to sit and unpack. Like, the things in my toolkit are like, here's how you, like, do that excavation, but I can't make the world give you the time to be able to do that.
Wow, I feel like you just dropped truth bombs, and they tasted like delicious apples. That's what that felt like. It's like, oh, incoming wisdom, and it's yummy. It's very yummy. I'm so with you. I'm so with you. Wow. Oh, it's good. Okay, so the direction I wanted to go in, and at any point, of course, feel free to chime in and say, hey, let's go in this direction instead.
The audio completely dropped out at that moment. Will you say it again?
Okay. So I was just saying the direction I wanted to go in previously, yes. Let's go in that direction. And also, at any point, feel free to chime in and, you know, okay, take us in any direction you want to go as well. Okay. So family constellations.
I'm so excited that you were coming. I saw that. I'm so excited that you were coming.
Oh my God. I love it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So family constellations. So before we go into this, I want to preface this with, my experience with sort of self-development and self-help and all this stuff, it's been like years and years of, you know, going to workshops and seminars, reading books and, you know, taking courses, retreats, yada, yada, yada. 99% of the time, and that may be a little dramatic, but 99% of the time for me, I was the only person of color in the room. And if I wasn't, it would be one other person of color. And if it wasn't just two, it'd be three. But this is like three in a room full of 50 or however many, or 20. And, you know, I am being a little dramatic. But the point is, that was something that for a while, I didn't think I noticed, or at least I didn't notice that I noticed. Because maybe I was noticing it and I was kind of suppressing that part of me that was noticing it. And so I was kind of just navigating through things that way because it was all I was used to and I didn't know any other experience. And so it was very much normalized. At some point in the last few years, there's this been acceleration of noticing things that I didn't know I was noticing. Or just noticing them for the very first time. And so since then, I've sort of been leaning into more and more, shying away from putting myself in spaces where, again, I am the only person of color. And also leaning into finding spaces in which the facilitation or the leadership is representative of people of color. And in some way, I can resonate on that level or relate on that level. And so anyway, all of that. Now, family constellations. I came across this maybe a couple years ago, 3 years ago. I Googled it, looked it up. I might be wrong now because my memory is not the best, but I think it was a German that came up with it and all this other stuff. So first of all, I've never been in a space where family constellation work was facilitated by a person of color. So that already was new for me in like meeting you. But there's also something on your website that you had mentioned, and I think it was something along the lines of Zulu medicine or Zulu something. So before you start talking about family constellations, I'd love to hear about that. And then, yeah, tell me all about family constellations, what that means to you.
Okay, wait. When you say you would like to hear me talk about that, was about the first part or the origins of family constellations?
The origins, okay. And then the first part and anything
so
else.
So here's what I know. What I know is that Bert Hellinger was a Jesuit priest and missionary who spent 16-some years in South Africa living very closely with the Zulu people. When he came back, he had a new framework for thinking about healing, and he blended this framework with various other things that were happening in the psychotherapy world. And he developed family constellations as we understand them to be, or as I have received them. And he doesn't really credit, you know, people credit Bert Hellinger with family constellations because of the way he set things up. People don't say, you know, these are the teachers or the people that Bert Hellinger learned from. And then this is what he developed from that, which is, I think, ludicrous. And he did a lot of like absurd things in the development of his framework, which is to some extent like, you know, what else can he do? He's a, like a white guy. And so it's like, there's a lot of racism and it's really like, if you read some of his things, there's like a lot of, you know, just all the not nice things that are present there. So that is what I know of the origins. And maybe I'll pause and ask, do you have questions? Mm-hmm. Or like, is there anything I can share more on?
No, I think that's great. Thank you. I didn't know that. Okay. And, but I do have a follow-up question, if that's okay. So how do you reconcile knowing what you know about the origins and kind of that not necessarily being accurately represented, or at least, you know, that part of the story not accurately represented with the work itself. And as like, in addition to that, also the kinds of things that you mentioned that are present in sort of the early development of this framework and the kind of things that were problematic, how do you reconcile those pieces?
It is a good question, and I grapple with them often. You know, I often grapple with the fact, I think, like you, a lot of the things that I had access to learning were because of my proximity to whiteness, because I could be in spaces that were predominantly white, because all of my NVC trainings, all of my family constellation training, any other modality that I've studied, oftentimes, you know, there's very few Black or Brown people in the room. And the reality is there is a time in my life when that was tolerable. There was a time in my life where I could go into those spaces and I could absorb information. And a lot of that was related to my unacknowledged conditioning, right? And the ways that I wasn't clocking what was happening in the room. And so family constellations have been such a powerful modality in the ways in which I've been invited to participate in them, the ways in which, you know, all these things. And I just have had a lot of questions about, is this medicine even mine to use? Is it okay? What are the practices of consent around it? And I've done the things that I know how to do, which is I've prayed a lot. One of my own teachers, whom I trust deeply, has communed with the ancestors and has given me the green light. And I think that that's a thing that I'm always open to, of like, is this still okay, right? Because consent is an ongoing practice. Is it still okay for me to be using this medicine? And so I don't have an answer to that. I just keep trusting and listening. And I don't practice the way that Hellinger laid it out. There's things that I think are trash, so I throw them away. And I try as much as possible to cultivate spaces where bodies who historically have not had access to family constellations feel safe coming into my spaces. I am aware that my spaces are not safe enough for some people. There are some people who, because of my proximity to whiteness, just wouldn't even feel safe being held by me in a container. And that is okay, right? Because part of the work, it comes back to that bridge building. We can only be so far of a bridge as like our bridge can travel. And so always a part of my work is also like, how do I transfer knowledge to people who can then take the tools into other places where it can go.
Beautiful. Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing more.
Oh my God, I saw that email. I was like, oh. Yeah.
Well, tell us about family constellations.
Family constellations are, the premise of family constellations is that love should flow downstream. Love is always reciprocal, but big person is supposed to take care of little person. So elder is supposed to take care of younger, and parent is supposed to be caregiver to the child and not the other way around. That when new life comes into the earth, to be in right relationship means that the elders in the community, the caregivers in the community, nurture and support that new being in living their true purpose. And that new being, they are in right relationship when they live the life that is theirs to lead. When harm happens, when trauma happens, that flow of love and that flow of care gets impacted. And our elders and our community members, our caregivers, lose the ability to provide that nurturance and that care that we need. And then what happens is, little person tries to flow the love back upstream. So little person tries as much as they can to undo the trauma or to provide the healing that is needed, oftentimes by taking on the weight of that trauma, by saying, you know what, grandpa, like this was the life journey you wanted and you didn't get to live it. So I'm going to live that journey for you and your purpose will be lived through me. which just then just creates further entanglements, further enmeshments, because none of that is in right relationship. Like I, and different facilitators, different people will have different practices. Our ancestors never want us to live their lives. Our ancestors never want us to heal their wounds. Our ancestors only want us to live the life that is right for us to live, so that they can receive from the power of being able to witness it and the power of being able to accompany us on our journey. Our ancestors have agency to heal their own wounds in their own times, in their own dimensions. So family constellation work is really looking at like, okay, you've got a block in your life path. Well, where are you tangled up with or enmeshed with or trying to resolve something that is actually not yours to carry? And then how can you put it down? And so it's a somatic modality. The way I facilitate, there's many ways you can facilitate. I only facilitate in collective containers because the collective is really important and is central to me and my work. So that's a bit about that.
Thank you. I had my eyes closed for a little while. You were speaking about ancestors. Every time I hear the word ancestors, it just, my eyes close and it feels real good. It feels real good. I just love that word, ancestors. There's something really beautiful about that. Wow. So I assume then that before you started facilitating this work, you were participating in it. Okay, cool. And then at what point did you think to yourself, maybe I shall, facilitate this?
You know, when I started studying family constellations, I was very aware there's no BIPOC facility. I was like, I couldn't find any. And there are some that I know of now, right? Francesca Mason-Boring is one. I've never studied with her, but she is someone that I know of. And there's some, I have friends who facilitate and they do beautiful work. But I began studying with the very explicit intention of being able to bring the work back into my community in ways that was accessible for us.
Yeah, beautiful. And I think you're doing that. So there's something I believe that you wanted to touch on, trauma responses and repair work. How I want to kind of tie that into family constellation work. So someone goes and starts working with this frame of reference or this toolkit, and they're participating in these different things, and now they're having a trauma response.
I'm not sure if I can weave them together in the way you've just set it up, but some things that I can say. One is that, one of the very first family constellation events that I went to, the very first constellation we did was for a father figure of this family. He was African American and was the patriarch, the father of the family, and his family was there in the space. And so we did that constellation and his lineage, we tracked the lineage and some of the things that were happening through enslavement and just mapped out all these different things. And that constellation came to a very beautiful close and just a very beautiful place of resonance and access with the ancestors. And it just so happened that the very next constellation that we did was for a white woman whose family, like part of her lineage, was like connected to the Mayflower, And I have some very visceral images of how painful that constellation was. And that constellation, it couldn't find its close. It was just so painful. And the legacies of abuse in her family were just very vivid. And, this was a family that had access to money. So it was a very strong learning lesson for me. It was really like the moment where I began to realize white supremacy doesn't work for anybody. Like white people might look like they're having a good time because they've got all the external tools and trimmings, but like inside, they are no, you know, inside things are not okay. Like they are no closer to God. They are no closer to divinity. In fact, they are further from it because they cannot have access to, they don't have access to so much of connection that makes life worth living. And then coming back to this, you know, this piece about the trauma responses, one of the spaces where I work with a lot of white people, a lot of my classes about nonviolence that are geared towards white folks are spaces for white folks to be in the deepening embodiment and complexity of their stuff, right? Like a lot of white people come to me and are very forthright about, here are the ways that I want to be in solidarity and in alignment with my values. And here's the trauma histories that I'm working with. Here's how my CPTSD and my freeze responses and my anxiety and my dissociation prevents me from standing up in the moments when I want to stand up. Will you please help me? And so that is what our work is centered around.
Ah, thank you. I there are moments in which when I'm having conversation with someone and I'm listening, and then I kind of just find myself deepening into this space of just wanting to listen and wanting to hear more. Because I'm laughing because it's a nice place to be in. And I also have to remind myself that, hey, you know, can also do a bit more talking than just listening. Because I could sit here and listen to you all day at this point. I could just sit here and listen. So I don't feel like I need to add anything. I can just sit here. And I have done that. I have done that in the past. So you're welcome to monologue your way through this. So to go back to trauma responses then, outside of tying it into family constellations, tying it into other parts of life, what does that mean to you, trauma responses? What does that look like?
I also don't know.
Oh, also?
But I think it's something that I think about often. I think about it a lot because I recognize freeze responses in myself when I don't stand up in time. You know, a lot of this other work that I mentioned that I do are trauma responses. They show up and they're real. And it's the work of how do we be accountable to both the reality of them as well as the broader context and world beyond us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. I don't know either. No, I just, being a human being, or like just being on this planet, you know, and the bodies that we're in and the experiences that we have, it's a mystery. like a lot of this is just like you think you figure it out and then you realize, oh, there's another new thing and I didn't really figure it out. And that just goes on and on and on. And there's this like constant, oh, wow, realization. And then, oh, wow, I didn't know what I know now. I didn't even know that I didn't know. And this just goes on and on. So I like going back to what you said earlier at one point, I don't know why. I mean, I do know why we have this expectation of ourselves, but we don't need to expect so much of ourselves in terms of like getting all of this done and figuring all of this out. And it's, yeah, we just don't have to figure
Gabriella,
it out.
Can I tell you something? Ever since you said the bit about like life being a mystery, I've just had Sarah McLachlan.
Yeah.
Softly playing underneath everything. I'm really excited to listen to that.
Oh my God. Well, you can sing it if you'd like. Or hum it.
You know, okay, I'm going to invite anybody who's listening. Just going to sing that one line because that's the only one that I actually know. Build it. Yeah, okay, that's what I got.
Oh. I love it. I love it. That's so good. Oh, man. Okay. What's been exciting for you recently in your life?
It's pretty exciting. So appreciative. I think because I like, you know, one of the things I talk about and teach often is that is play is the place where we know that we belong. And play is the place where transformation can occur. And so I just love these moments where there's a moment of depth and then like middle school Minachi comes in and it's like built in.
Yep. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's so funny. That's good. That's really good. Yeah. It's good. I think half the time, at least for me, I think half the time when I'm laughing or really, you know, enjoying something to the point of laughter, it's because I think it's very true. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the truth of it. It's almost like the laughter is an expression of recognizing something, something as being true. There's a question that I try and ask all of the guests, and I try and frame it differently based on the person. But often I don't know what the right way of framing it is for each person, because I think, and this is an entirely different conversation, but I think there are different frameworks and perceptions with which we navigate through life and with how we communicate. And I think there are different ways of using language or words to describe things or relate to them. And so when I say, for example, a question like, how does your diaspora identity, how has it informed your life? Or, you know, how have you noticed it being present in your life? Or how does it inform your life now? I could also reframe that and say, how does
there is no
your diaspora identification or identification with it. There are so many ways of saying different things that half the time, actually this goes right back to the play. 'Cause for me, it is all, a lot of it is fun and is playful, because I think that there's really no one way. No one size fits all. It's just you have a conversation with one person and the words that you're using with that person make sense in that conversation. And then you're talking to the next person and none of those words are words that they resonate with or words that they can relate back to any experiences they've had in their life, because they're not perceiving, they're just not, how do I put this? They're not using the same paintbrush or set of paintbrushes. They're using different colors. And so the greens and the blues for one person are actually more like black and red for the next. And so like a lot of it for me is I've kind of found myself in a place where I take things seriously and I also don't take them seriously, because it just can change from moment to moment and from person to person. So that's why that's just like my very long-winded way of saying, I want to ask you about your any experience or any experiencing that you've had in reference or in relation to the identity that is the diaspora identity. And you can take that in whatever way you want and say whatever you feel like saying about that.
It's actually a very generous invitation to talk about that. It's so tender and so deep. So my people are, how do I even talk about this? That's not true. I will talk about it how I talk about it. And then we'll add other information along the way. So my people are from Sri Lanka. We're from Jaffna, which is in the north. roughly since the 50s, there has been ongoing ethnic erasure and genocide of my people, just how we ended up in diaspora. And the reason that I kind of started laughing when you initially asked, because there's no way for me to honestly answer this question without angering somebody or infuriating somebody in my diaspora, because we're so fractured and there's so much harm that exists within the Tamil community. You know, there's people who would legitimately call me a traitor to our people for saying that I'm from Sri Lanka because I use those words. Many people, you know, people are always looking for the words that feel right for them. Some people will say Uram, some people will say Ilange. I will oftentimes say Ceylon, which is actually colonial, like when we were under British rule. And I will sometimes say that I'm from Ceylon because that is the name that my mother first learned to call home. And in many ways, it is still what she calls home. And so I think that my diaspora identity is one of the ways that I just began to look at what is the true nature of everything? What is the true nature of everything? And how are we always reflected in all the other pieces? And I think the really deep requirement to have space to hold complexity, to have space to hold multiple truths, to have space to hold deep care, and the space to look at context beyond our context, because my people would not be in mass graves today if we had not participated in upholding forms of colonialism before that. There's so many levels and layers to how harm rolls out and where we sit in the mix of things. And I don't know, you know, I've just said a big statement, and maybe in 5 minutes, maybe in 5 years, I'll look back at that and be like, I wish I could scratch that. But, you know, one of the things that I think is very true is that my people participated in systems of harm.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh my gosh. So I have this housemate who uses the word edgy a lot. he says edgy, he like prefaces things with, I'm about to be edgy. I'm about to say something that's edgy. And so I've started, I took this on. And so I've been doing it ever since I met him. Before I say something edgy, I'll say, I'm about to say something edgy. And I've actually been loving the laughter. It's great. It's, oh, man. Yeah, so I've been leaning into this being more edgy. And really, for me, what that means is leaning into giving myself permission to be more vocal about the kinds of things that I experience or think I am experiencing without holding back. Because, you know, on one level, of course, there's the part of me that's trying to be aware of the way in which what I say can cause harm or may cause harm. And you know, there's a part of me that's kind of filtering things. And there's also a part of me that wants to try, you know, saying things that maybe feel edgy. And so what you just said maybe is edgy for some people. And I appreciate you saying that because it, for me, feels empowering in my experience of leaning into, like, saying things that maybe come off as edgy. That said, I'm going to say something that's edgy now.
Let's hear it. Go.
So, I, like, what you shared is something I resonate with, because when kind of exploring and connecting with my own ancestry and my own heritage and, you know, my people, I like at some point I realized that, oh, wow, there is a lot of participation there in systems of oppression and systems of violence. We, and when I say we, my ancestors, my people, we are not innocent in this. You know, like, there may have been occasions and periods of time, and even now, you know, where we've been the oppressed and have been victims, but we've also been the oppressor. And this is something that, for me, I first began to work through on an individual personal level, where I started to notice, but this was like years ago now, I started to notice the way in which the oppressor in me manifests and the way that shows up. And that was really, really hard to work through, I gotta say. And it still continues to be, you know, there are still things that I'm still working on, because it's really hard to face, to look at those faces, which are my faces. But, you know, to kind of turn my face to the left and see kind of that sort of the oppressor, the aggressor. So then, more recently, as I began to kind of lean into connecting with my ancestry, that same work began to surface for me. And now I'm trying to do it, or working through it, on more of a collective level, and the collective being me and my ancestors. And so I recognize, I am recognizing and acknowledging the oppressor and the aggressor and the violence in my ancestry, in my heritage, in myself, in my people. Because it's one thing to recognize the trauma and work through that and heal. And I think part of that process is also recognizing the causes of trauma that we have participated in. Mm. And so, yeah, what you said, I resonate with that, because it's at least it's true for me. Mm-hmm. It's true for me. And, you know, I understand why it's hard to look at that kind of stuff, because when we're working through trauma and we're working through feeling oppressed or experiencing systems of oppression, we're more often than not feeling angry and resentment. And so when we're feeling angry, we don't necessarily want to start feeling like, oh, maybe there are ways in which we participate, the ways in which we oppress others, or contribute to systems of oppression. Nobody's got time for that. Not when you're angry. I mean, at least not for me. Not when I'm angry, I don't want to do that. You know, but when I'm not angry, then sure, I'll look at that. But I feel you. How do you feel about that, about what I've just shared?
I really appreciate you sharing it. And I think it also brings up the piece around, like, right, like, there's so many truths that are unspoken, in the sense of, like we're in this conversation, but there's only so many sentences, there's only so many words, there's only so many things that can be covered. And there's, like, going to be people who are listening who, for example, haven't sufficiently had their wounds acknowledged in order to be able to look at, well, how have we been complicit in participation? Or, like, you know, when I think we have to have a certain amount of needs met in order to be able to begin to do the introspective work. Like, enough of our grief has to be held before we can feel free to look inward sometimes.
Yeah. And why do you think that is the case?
I think it's just math. Like, it's just how physiology works. It's just 2 + 2, 1 + 3, 5 - 1, however you want to go. But, like, you know, 2 + 7 will never equal 11. So we just have to have enough needs met. And there's some deep spirit stuff to that, right? Because it's also, I think, like, I think that there's also pieces of it that are, like, you know, the needs that have been met in this lifetime, but also the needs that have been met in lifetimes before, or the lineages we're holding. I think there's a lot more to it than maybe we sometimes acknowledge.
I just want that song again, just that one line. And it's what I'm waiting for.
Now it's playing over an image of like a cat puzzle, like a 1,000-piece cat puzzle. It's just cat faces, right? Because you can't.
Well, this has been a beautiful conversation. I half wish it was more of a monologue, so I could have just sat here and listened to you.
The musical interludes were a part of it, came from the dialogue.
Yeah, but it has been a beautiful conversation, and I appreciate it. And, you know, one of the things that I'm coming away with is that in witnessing you embodying your gifts so gracefully and embodying play so gracefully, and just this willingness or just this presence of raw honesty, I'm walking away feeling empowered, and also like with this anticipation of someday soon I will recognize and witness myself in the same way. And I don't mean that, you know, I don't recognize my cool ass gifts and all that stuff now, but I mean that in the way that I have witnessed you today, that same quality of witnessing, that's what I will witness. And that's really cool. Because yeah, I'm just, that's a beautiful gift, and I'm looking forward to it. And essentially, it's like I'm sitting in the house that is my perception of the world, and we've had a conversation, and you were outside my window, and I was looking out the window, and I saw you doing this stuff. You were singing that song with the cat puzzles and all the cat faces, and cool. Now I know what that looks like, and you're leaving, but you're leaving this recording with the song playing on repeat and the cat puzzle. And so I'm at some point going to be outside with this song and the cat puzzle, and then I will remember the moment in which, you know, I was looking out the window and witnessing you outside in that exact space. So I'm looking forward to that, and I appreciate that. I think that's a beautiful gift, and maybe none of that made sense to anybody, but it makes sense to me. And so it doesn't matter. All I'm trying to say is your presence today was a gift, and I appreciate it, and I'm walking away with blessings from it. So thank you. That said, if you have any final thoughts, this would be the time to share those. That could be anything you want that to be. You can sing that song, you can do a prayer, you can just say nothing. But yeah, thank you. Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I think what's left in my heart and in my stomach is appreciation and gratitude to you for your time and space holding, because I think that sometimes we bring out each other's shadows, sometimes we bring out each other's light, and anytime I'm in the presence of somebody who brings out my light, I both never forget that I also have shadows, and I'm also grateful to be able to remember my light. So thank you.
Thank you. Don't forget to leave the puzzle behind.
I brought the puzzle. You brought that puzzle to the picnic.
I guess I forgot. Oh man. Well, thank you. Woo-wee. That was our episode. Our third episode with Minachi, and it was awesome. Wasn't that awesome? I mean, I thought that was awesome. I think there was a lot of laughter, and I think that's probably what I'm going to remember the most is the laughing. That was truly a beautiful, beautiful conversation. I think we co-created a wonderful, fun, playful space, which is just great. And I'll tell you something. I told this to someone recently. You're probably all going to hear about my housemates quite a bit, just because I love talking about my housemates. But I recently told my housemate this thing. We were talking about, you know, dating, and when people ask you, like, what are you looking for in a person or in a relationship? And for me, the answer is always fun, you know, and that's not just, you know, romantic related. It's just in general. Is there fun to be had? You know, is there room for playfulness? Because that's, you know, life is, life is something, and it's a lot more fun when you're laughing. It's a lot more fun when you're being playful. That's not to say that, you know, it needs to be that way. I'm just saying that I like fun. Anyway, that was an incredible conversation. So, so grateful to Minaji for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I hope you come back, share this far and wide. And hey, if you think someone you know would be a great fit to be a guest on this podcast, please do reach out. And if you want to just reach out and have a conversation or continue this conversation, feel free to do that on any of the socials. Hashtag the Almas Podcast. Lots of love to you all, and we'll see you next time. Cuckoo.